Welcome to the Flow Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 8:59 p.m. and that is Central Time. Today is November 5th, and of course it's Friday, so it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. It's not very often that I get my days mixed up, but I'm going to put it down to the rather swift travel schedule I had this week. So when I was recording the audio earlier on today, I had not realized it was still Friday. I was still on Thursday time, so I do apologize for that. And I did a reasonably complete audio, but there were a couple of different things that I would like to cover, but I will go over everything else as well. And I will start off with the Baltic Dry Index, because it's coming down hard, and this is something that we've seen quite a bit. That we've had these explosions on the upside, and then we've had these abrupt declines, and it's happened across asset classes. And all of this has been down to the pandemic, and it's a rolling effect because, particularly in agriculture, when you've got a lengthy planting season, well, you don't really see the repercussions of less planting until you're well into harvest. And of course, then that increases the susceptibility of prices to adverse weather conditions, and we've had plenty of examples of that as well. So then that also contributes to inflationary pressures. And there's lots of different sources of inflationary pressure, and a lot of things are contributing to this perspective that we are in a new inflationary cycle. Well, of course, one good reason is that we've had massive monetary accommodation. So, but let's first think about the Baltic Dry Index. It rallied spectacularly, and in the last couple of weeks, we've heard people talking about how prices for shipping goods around the world have gone up 10 times, and it's been used by salespeople quite regularly to justify higher prices for the goods that they're trying to sell. But the peak was around 5,500. We are now down to 2,715, and well, the highs of the last decade were around 2,000. So yes, prices are up, but they're not up that much. And then, of course, we have these scare stories about how the supply chain is never going to be fixed. Well, I remember subscribing to that kind of view after Hurricane Katrina. I was long of natural gas, and I was way in the money, and I really thought that they were never going to be able to get that supply back on track in a timely manner, and I was wrong. And they got that supply back online in the Gulf of Mexico in record time, and prices came down with a bang. Well, when we then think about what's going on in the global supply chain, there are certainly empty containers in places where they're not needed, and there is a lack of incentive to get them to where they are needed. So that's certainly a problem. There is a dearth of rail cars to ship them around the place. And then there is the whole issue of unions, wages, and testing protocols. And that's been a significant problem in Los Angeles port. And the kinds of conditions that those people earn are beyond the comprehension of most regular workers. They are basically sitting on top of a choke point in the global supply chain, and they can do whatever they want because there's no getting them out of that position. It would require warfare to remove these unions from these choke points. So you have people that are earning in excess of $400,000 to $500,000 a year that are taking weeks off, and then when they just close down the whole shift when one person tests positive without testing anybody else, and they don't have an incentive to speed up. And one can only imagine how much money at the likes of Walmart and Target have paid to ensure that their goods get through at night. And this has certainly helped to support the shares. Well, then you can also think about supply chain issues for Apple. And certainly, Apple did have a bit of a wobble because they said that they're going to have trouble getting all of the electronics that they wanted for the holiday season, and yet the share continues to rebound. So then let's just go back and think about this whole supply chain issue, because Qualcomm came out with their results in here today. The share was up in a dynamic manner this week, and this is a very strong performance. But what they had to say was that they have distributed their manufacturing among different suppliers. They've succeeded in circumventing the supply chain difficulties, and that they anticipate that the supply chain difficulties will have been resolved by the time we get to the end of the second quarter. And I find that particularly interesting. The Federal Reserve has been quite clear that they think that inflationary pressures are going to be transitory. And they've also started their quantitative easing program. So they're still adding new liquidity, but it's going to get smaller by about 15 billion a month until the program expires at the end of June. And it's not simply Qualcomm talking about the end of the second quarter, because I've also seen some of the automotive executives saying that they anticipate that they'll be able to build as many cars as they wish by the middle of next year. Volkswagen was quite clear in stating that in one of their earnings calls in September. And the share has pulled back rather abruptly over the last 6 months, but now it's steadying in the region of the trend mean. And this is a clear example here of where we've had a very big surge on the upside. It's come down slower than it went up, and now we're looking at some possible support building. Of course, if they can solve their supply issues and start meeting some of the excess demand for vehicles, because a lot of people have wanted to change their vehicle, a lot of people on leases have been phoned out of the blue by departments that they're not familiar with and asked would they be willing to sell their vehicles, but of course they don't have the cars to put them into new ones, and everyone is waiting for new vehicles, and the price of secondhand vehicles has gone haywire. And there's the real possibility that they'll come straight back down again, and that we will see a large number of price series look exactly like lumber, where you get this extraordinary move on the upside, and then you get a crushing decline, and then prices stabilize at historically high levels, which is exactly what we're seeing with lumber. Well, of course, the other big exaggerated move that we've had was in natural gas, and particularly in Europe. So UK natural gas prices went on an extraordinary journey, going from an exaggerated low in March, or excuse me, May of 2020, around 7, and they traded up to more than 450. So we've had a swift decline. Now, natural gas supply chains aren't easily going to be replenished. So this is something that's going to take time. And then, of course, we have the added problems with the intermittency and unpredictability of wind patterns. And that's obviously something that is going to need to be addressed eventually. But natural gas prices are unlikely to go back down into the base formation. Now, they could still halve from where they are right now, but that doesn't mean that they're going to go all the way back down into the base. So when people see this, and we look at commodities like wheat, where prices are coming up now to areas which are problematic for many people. So the price has eased back over the course of the last few days, and it's now sitting around the 800 or 750 to 800 area, and Back in 2011 and 12, it was those kinds of levels corresponded with a lot of social unrest in the Middle East, and the Arab Spring kicked off in Tunisia because people were worried about the rising cost of bread. Well, if wheat is one important commodity, palm oil is equally important. It's an ingredient in everything. And the price got up to 500 ringgit in here today. And we're seeing a little bit of a pause in consolidation, but this has been an extraordinary move over the course of the last 12 months. And it's a clear base formation completion. And there isn't really an answer to replacing it. So palm oil is still a very significant commodity, and it's also ramping up in price. So that's contributing to inflationary pressures in food commodities. But what we have examples of here then are some commodities that are surging on the upside, and shipping rates that are plummeting, and natural gas prices that have pulled back, but not all that much relative to the size of the advance. Then we have semiconductors, where yes, there are certainly supply challenges, but the stocks are now starting to break on the upside because we're coming out the other end of it. So we might now be at peak disruption, and things might start to look better in the not so distant future. But then, of course, we have the kinds of inflation where and these are, of course, the kinds of inflation that central banks actually measure, which are wages and the cost of housing. So wage growth has been picking up, and it's really not all that difficult to explain. When you give people more money and better benefits for doing nothing than from working, well, they obviously start to think about why weren't they getting them in the first place. And there's all this talk about universal basic income, and anyone with any kind of just logical thinking would perhaps come to the conclusion that if you remove the incentive to work, people won't work, and that productivity will decline. But nonetheless, we're halfway there already, and there's the real possibility that as we go forward, central banks will attempt to become more efficient in the kind of largesse that they pour into the economy, because we have now started to see direct transfers to consumers, and that's quite different from the quantitative easing that we had in the aftermath of the credit crisis. Now, we also know that the vast majority of people saved that transfer. So then we can also think about that that's not really what it was for. The whole purpose of giving people additional money is that they'll go out and spend it, and that they will really start to juice the economy. So I think it is very likely that we're going to see measures underway that central banks will have the ability to put money into people's accounts and take it back if they don't spend it. And that would introduce a time value to the money, and it would, of course, change the nature of money, but we've had lots of that already. But it would greatly enhance the efficiency and the knowledge of money and transactions that central banks have. And it does, I think, look like that's the way that things are going. So I don't think it's beyond the bounds of possibility at all that the next time we have a crisis, and I'm not anticipating we have a crisis imminently, but we will have novel solutions to some of these issues. And putting a time limit on money would be a lot easier with a central bank digital currency. And it's looking increasingly likely that we're also going down that direction. So I will just relate an anecdote. I was talking with one of the parents in my daughter's class, and she's a dentist. And during the pandemic, they had to close the office down, and everybody went home. And then their hygienist didn't want to come back because she was making decent money from being unemployed, and she wouldn't want to. She expressed a fear about COVID until her unemployment benefits ran out. And then when she came back, she wanted more money and she wanted an assistant. And of course, the hygienist is an assistant to the dentist in the first place. So now what you really have is you have an assistant who wants an assistant. And finally, they just had to let her go, but they haven't been able to replace her because everyone's in the same boat. That the reality is that it's not just that people were making more money from being unemployed than from working, but we've all had to look at the possibility of our fatality in the last year. And when one looks at one's demise and starts thinking about what death might look like, well, then what time one has becomes more precious, and people demand more money, and it's really not that difficult to understand. So that's where the source of inflation is coming from. And at the same time, we're also going to have people coming back into the workforce because the excess unemployment benefits have expired, and as months drag on, people will start to come back into the workforce. That's why I think it's particularly important to monitor delinquencies. And delinquencies are still at extraordinarily low levels. And don't exactly know why that's not giving me the up-to-date chart. So we can clearly see here that delinquency has been at an extraordinarily low level. Well, when this starts to tick back upwards and it's updated quarterly, well, then we'll have graphic evidence that people are beginning to experience financial stress, and then they'll be much more encouraged to take jobs. Now, of course, it doesn't mean they're going to be happy to take the job, but they will be taking jobs if they start getting late notices on credit card bills. So I don't think it's at all beyond the bounds of possibility that some of the pressures on the workforce begin to ebb, and that people do start to come back into the workforce. There's a lot of talk in particularly the more liberal media about the Great Resignation, and the equivalent in the USA and Europe of the Chinese lie down movement, where the millennial generation just simply decides to not partake in the rat race. Well, I think that's all well and good to talk about, but if their ability to fund their lives expires, well, then people will have to go back to work. I think a much more relevant consideration is that we've had a mass retirement. When you have a stock market that has doubled in the space of a year, then that helps to really flatter the performance of a lot of portfolios. And suddenly, retirement looks a lot more attractive for a lot more people. So then those people are unlikely to go back to the workforce because their portfolios are doing well and they can now fund their lifestyles. So it does mean that we're going to have a slow burn in terms of the correction in the labor force participation rate. So I think that's something that is an inhibiting factor. And when we then think about what does that mean in terms of inflation? Well, inflationary pressures are mostly about wages, and then mostly about living costs. Don't know why, again, that's not working. So labor force participation went from 63.5% and it has stabilized now at 61.6. So we've lost 2% of the workforce in the pandemic. So that's a significant number of people that were contributing to the workforce, and they're now detractors and are dependent on whatever they can get from the economy rather than contributing to it. And that's obviously a limiting factor in productivity. So we have a lot of money floating around. We have a lot of volatility in prices for goods and services. But wage demand growth is likely to persist, even if it ebbs and flows as well. And labor force participation represents a headwind because it is going to be a background support for wage demand growth. So these are, I think, some of the more important points that are going to contribute to inflationary pressures. But then, of course, we have this profound move this week in some of the government bonds because the 10-year yield came back down with a bang in here today and closed below the 150 area. It's hovering around the region of the 200-day moving average. And it wasn't simply US bonds. The UK did not raise interest rates this week. So that created some demand for bonds, and we've had a very significant downward dynamic. So it's coming straight back down through the 1% level. This is looking increasingly like a failed upside break. Well, if it's a failed upside break, and I think it's a bit early to conclude that just yet, but if it starts coming back below the trend mean, well, then it will certainly be a failed upside break. Well, then that would certainly begin to point towards a run back down towards the lows. And I think this is a very big change that we've had in UK interest rates this week. But what it is in fact saying is that we have inflationary pressures, and some of them are being mitigated, and some aren't. But because of the volatility of the price series, it's very difficult for central banks to draw clear conclusions because this kind of volatility, they're just not accustomed to it. It's just completely outside their wheelhouse to see such incredible volatility in everything they look at. So they're going to be very reluctant to raise rates. And yet, we still have these strong background influences that are boosting inflationary pressures. And that's why gold is popping on the upside. Gold does best, the shorthand for when gold does best is a negative real interest rate environment. But in plain English, what that means is that inflationary pressures are rising, central banks are unable or inhibited from raising rates, and therefore gold is an answer to that problem. So gold appreciates when central banks are inhibited from doing their jobs. So we've been through a lengthy consolidation, and this triangular pattern has been forming now for most of the last 6 months. And one thing that I find particularly interesting is that we have got a great deal of very negative commentary about gold in the very recent past. People have been talking quite loudly about the potential for gold to fall down to $1,500. And they have been clearly worried about volatility. But there is a gold volatility measure. And let me see if I can find it. Gold volatility was really high in 2020. And over the course of the last 6 months, it has come down a lot. So the volatility in the range has contracted, but the emotionality of people in the market has increased, and there's a lot to play for because the bulls are really bullish. They believe that This is a new bull market that will make every other bull market pale into insignificance. And the others are saying that we've had all these pressures that should have been supportive for gold over the course of the last year, and they haven't worked, and the price has gone nowhere. And look at these big downward dynamics we've seen in the period from August through to about June of 2021. And of course, both of them have got a valid argument, and we're in a range. So that also tells us that supply and demand is back in equilibrium. Now, when you get the volatility of the price action contracting, but the volatility of the arguments increasing, well, then we also know that people are starting to accumulate on the dips. They're starting to let out supply on the rallies. It means that vacuums of support below and supply above the range are forming. Now, when that eventually breaks, then you're going to see prices rally into those vacuums. And if it's on the upside, we're going to see an exaggerated move on the upside, and it will be faster and go further than anyone has been used to, because we've all been conditioned to expect not much from gold on the upside over the course of the last year. Now, of course, if the bears were going to take control and the sequence of higher reaction lows were broken, then we could see the vacuum of supply under the market broken. But in an uptrend, that vacuum of supply will be harder to form. And then, of course, we have to conclude, or we have to reach a conclusion. Is gold in a bull market or not? Well, then it comes back to that inflationary question. Now, if central banks are unwilling to raise rates and inflationary pressures moderate, does not mean that they disappear. But inflationary pressures could certainly moderate. And that isn't going to be because of oil prices, because crude oil has bounced from the $80 area in here today. You have Joe Biden, for example, talking about a potentially releasing some supply from the Strategic Reserve. Of course, then that begs the question, where is the additional supply going to come from to refill it? And isn't it a bit early for releasing supply? Of course, when we look at prices, one thing that's, I think, particularly relevant is that consumers are seeing that the price at the pump is close to record highs in a number of areas. But when we look at the crude oil price, well, we're a long way from the all-time peak. So, when we think about that, well, why is it that we've had this extraordinary move in prices? And of course, what people don't really talk about is that there's a lot of tax that goes on gasoline, and there's a lot of regulations about how it can be transported, and all of that adds to the cost. So the average daily price of gasoline is approaching the peaks from back in 2011 and 13, and they're obviously wondering about what they can do to try and bring this back down, because it's an election issue. So obviously, this is something that they'll want to try and to address. Well, electrifying the entire economy could help to bring down demand for oil, but it's not a short-term solution. The short-term solution is to drill, and there's not a lot of appetite for that. So basically, what's happened is that this reluctance to engage with the ESG lobby has robbed the oil majors of their ability to supply and to be a marginal source of supply for the global economy. And it's handing more power to OPEC and Russia, and they're less inclined to increase supply because they want the money. So when we think about the Saudi Arabian stock market, there's an increasing number of IPOs, and it continues to rally and to do so in a clearly accelerated manner because they're raking money in with prices continuing to trend higher, and they've regained control. So this is a really favorable time for OPEC. I was not really of the view that oil prices could sustain a move above 80 because I simply assumed that we would have more drilling, and I think there will be more drilling, but will it be on a scale necessary to really put a dent in the supply deficit? And then, of course, there is the additional question, and it's will the cost of production from shale start to increase? Because one of the big targets from the COP26 meeting in Glasgow this week has been methane. And of course, methane's a significant byproduct of shale drilling. So, trying to ensure that that is contained and that flaring of excess gas is something that's going to end is going to represent an additional source of new demand. When we then think about the wider question of inflation, now I don't know why my Bloomberg just died on me, so I may have to start it up again. Well, one thing that we know about inflationary pressures is, particularly if we go back and look at what happened in the 1970s, it was clear that what we'd had was waves of inflation. And I suspect that that's what we're looking at now. So the clear risk is that some people believe that in the supply chain disruptions will never end, and it's going to deter people from paying attention to the fact that these things are going to end and that we're eventually going to see the supply chain corrected. And that isn't going to be the end of the inflationary problem. I think when we think then about this kind of volatility that we're seeing, well, it means that there's going to be a lot of trading around of this idea. And we're going to have the same kinds of arguments made about the outlook for inflation in probably about 6 to 8 months from now that we are having today about gold. Because if inflationary pressures start to come back down, then a lot of investors are going to conclude that there's really nothing to worry about, and that this is it's the dog that didn't bark again, and that would continue to support this contraction in government bond yields. Well, that's going to be very beneficial for asset prices. But wage demand growth and an unwillingness then of central banks to raise rates, because if inflation starts to come back down and they still have worries about labor force participation and unemployment and equality, well, then they're not going to be as aggressive in raising rates. So we might have inflation moderate from say 4 to 2.5%. That's still well above what anyone was really willing to believe was even possible before the pandemic. And it would be very beneficial for asset prices, which is why I think what's happening with the yield curve is so important, because it's looking increasingly likely that the peak was at 150 basis points. Now, if that's indeed the case, well, we know from experience that the inversion of the yield curve is a useful lead indicator for future recessions. So we had an inversion in late 20 or 2019, and it popped back up again, but that was or that did set the clock going for a recession. And of course, the pandemic occurred with such speed, and central banks acted with alacrity, so they then avoided some of the worst selling pressure. And usually, the selling pressure arrives as the price, or excuse me, the spread moves through the 150 basis point level. So that was certainly the case in 2008. It was also certainly the case in 2001 through to 3. On this occasion, we only got up to 150 basis points, and now the spread is starting to come back down. Now, if it starts to come back down below the 100 basis point level, well, then at the higher peak, excuse me, the lower peak value will be confirmed, and that would suggest that the stock market is going to continue to trend higher, and that we're going to move into a phase in the stock market that will be similar to the period from about 1998 through to 2000. So, in other words, the bubbly phase. When we think about the phenomenal bull markets, well, the Nasdaq now is really at a significant multiple of where the peak was back in 2000. And we had an orderly consolidation in the region of the peak back in 2015 and 16, and since then the price has gone up four, or the index has gone up four times. And it's still trending consistently. It still has ranges one above another. And as long as that remains the case, well, then we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Now, when we think about the logarithmic scale chart, I think it's important to pay attention to log scale charts when you get accelerations, because the trend becomes really incredibly consistent. And you start to see prices moving higher in an exceptional manner. And obviously, if you're levered, then looking at a log scale chart isn't going to be beneficial, because the number of points moved can be profound, both up and down. And yet it may not show up on a log scale chart. But for the big investors, the big unleveraged funds, well, they only pay attention to percentage gains, and that's what we're seeing in the log scale chart. So the Nasdaq remains in a consistent advance. If we look at just on a percentage basis, the size of the reactions has been incredibly consistent, even during the big surprise in 2020, which lasted for 2 months. This was only marginally larger. And since then, the size of the reactions has got smaller. So there is no questioning of the fact that we are now in the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. And the speculation surrounding the metaverse is really quite incredible. So, the one thing that defines all manias is contradiction. And logical inconsistencies are accepted as truth, as if they must be true and make perfect sense. And we have so many examples of contradiction in the market that you're practically falling over them. But I think what's going on in the NFT market and the price of these JPEG images that are surging by thousands of percent, when All someone has to do to gain ownership is copy and paste. Well, you can do whatever you want to copy these items, and yet the value and ownership of them is increasing. And then we're looking at the it's eerily similar to the South Sea bubble. We can think about the area of the South Sea, which is extraordinarily small in terms of land mass, and it propelled an enormous bubble in speculation of people wishing to lock down their claim. And that's exactly what we're seeing in the metaverse, where there are a proliferating number of metaverses, and you can participate and you can buy property. You have rappers like Snoop Dogg are building mansions inside the metaverse, and then there are, as people design various pieces for it, they become individual NFTs, and then limited supply of those contributes to prices for things like swimming pools inside the metaverse, jumping higher and becoming unaffordable for people who have come later. And the quantity of money that is being poured into this sector is extraordinary. So this is where we have some really funny business going on, because people anticipate that they're going to spend as much time in the metaverse as they do offline, or that they're going to use it to the same extent that they use social media, and that it will replace social media and become a destination in itself. Now, you can access the metaverse via your desktop or via your phone, or the better way, the most enjoyable way, is via a VR headset. The challenge with the VR headsets is that they're kind of heavy and they're kind of sweaty, and especially when you're turning your head and moving around and looking at things, and it's not as comfortable using a VR headset while you're sitting down, and there's a lot of hand movement that takes place. Well, I turned 45 yesterday. I can definitely attest to that for 45-year-old eyes. Then they just don't work very well when you've got after you've had a VR headset on for about half an hour. And I was getting stars in front of my eyes from doing that, and they were getting really tired. So either the technology has to improve a lot to deal with those kinds of stresses, or we're going to have to see Neuralink from Tesla or from Elon Musk deliver, and not just repeat the kinds of experiments that were done on pigs 40 years ago. But of course, the other clear conclusion is that this is like the emperor has no clothes, and that none of this is going to make any sense at all. That what we're in fact seeing is it's an offshoot of the drive into the cryptocurrencies, because the defining characteristic of the Bitcoin craze is the fear of missing out. And most people understand that it's pretty unlikely that you're going to have the same gain in Bitcoin in the future that you've had in the past, because it's not going to go from a $1 value to 67,000 again. And therefore, when you're being proposed with some of these inane types of solutions to problems that don't exist, well, then it becomes almost a parody of the original argument for a decentralized currency, and it's creating decentralized properties, but not properties, but rather just trivial items. That's very different from the evolution of smart contracts and a way of recording ownership that's entirely public. And of course, one of the nice things about the conventional financial system is privacy. And I don't know about anyone else, but the last thing I want is for my financial details or the details of ownership to be on a blockchain. I don't want people knowing what I'm doing. That's the primary reason that I'm not on social media at all. The last thing I want is people I don't remember from school or anywhere else I've been looking me up and wanting to be friends or seeing details of my lifestyle. That's absolutely anathema to me, but I do understand that that's something that's attractive to a lot of people. But of course, perhaps I'm just not as social as other people. Well, then when we think about what's going on here, well, the price action of Facebook tells us that it's got a fighting chance that it's going to be able to sell this idea. Well, the reason that they are so eager to sell it is because Facebook has been wanting to try and mimic the actions of Alibaba and Tencent for a good long time now. Because one of the great successes of WeChat and WeChat Pay is that it added banking services and payment services to pretty much a copycat of Instagram. So these companies have been hit hard by regulation in China recently, and Facebook has pretty much bet the farm on the view, at least, that they're going to be able to create a digital currency proxy for WeChat Pay or Alipay, and that will allow them to access a whole new demographic. It's getting increasingly difficult to access that new demographic, and it took Facebook about 8 years to get to 1 billion users, and it took TikTok about 5. But Fortnite got to 500 million users in less than 3 years, and that's just a computer game. But one thing that I think is interesting is that Roblox is accessing an even younger demographic, and they've got about 300 million people using their platform. And they're also allowing people to design items and sell items within the platform. So they're already creating a little digital universe for children. And so there is certainly the potential that the kinds of trends that have evolved in computer games, where you can buy skins for your character and that people are more than willing to pay for them and put a premium on them, well, then that could potentially translate into supply and demand functionality within an online community. Of course, then the big question is, how does that truly translate into the trade for goods and services? Well, one thing that Ethereum has been very clear in trying to attain is that they want to be different from Bitcoin, and they want to start paying dividends. They want to be the smart contract provider, and that's a different proposition from the supply inelasticity argument that supports Bitcoin. But of course, you need to transact in both Ethereum and Bitcoin if you're going to participate in all of these other weird and wonderful little marketplaces. And of course, the big question is then, how much of a store of value are these units? And I do think that it is quite like the bull market in the late 1990s, which built the infrastructure for the internet. And then subsequently, the next bull market was about use cases for the internet. And Right now, what we're doing is building the blockchains and building the networks and trying to figure out the business models. And eventually, I would say a good half of all of the crypto projects are going to go bust and completely disappear. And eventually, we're going to have regulation, and the stable coins will be treated like money market funds, and that's a good thing. And that will then create a more, in inverted commas, respected environment where we can see true transparency of what these things are actually holding. Because that's where transparency is really needed. Not so much on the individual level, but in how the assets that are supporting these cryptocurrencies are allocated. That's where we need to have true visibility and to have people so that they can have confidence in what they're buying. And that's an opaque question right now. So we have these inflationary pressures. We have bull markets that are going to be further supplemented by the temporary easing of inflationary pressures, the reluctance of central banks to raise rates. I think that there's the clear potential that we're looking at a new bull market in gold. And then we have this whole question about what's going on in China. Because the property market is under stress. And the stock market is trading below the trend mean, and there's a triangular pattern forming here as well. We still have the lower highs and we still have the higher reaction lows. And in this case, I think we're no longer in an uptrend, and there's the real possibility that the price is going to break lower. And the CSI real estate sector is barely steady in the region of the lower side of its range. It was down again in here today, testing the lows. But we have this extremely lengthy range, and it's extraordinarily volatile, going from 6,000 to 12,000 and back again. So we have ranging, we have time, and we have size. This looks like a type 3 top formation. And if that's the case, and it breaks downwards, well, then we're looking at the completion of a type 3 top. And it could come all the way back down to the lows seen in 2008. It might even come lower than that. So that would suggest that the Chinese real estate sector will lose two-thirds of its value if it breaks downwards from here. So we're in a profoundly difficult environment for China right now because the politics have overtaken the economy as a national priority. And the time when China was growing its way out of trouble ended a decade ago. And the debt ratios have expanded substantially. Now you have this situation where the party is looking at the property market and 50 million vacant units, and the sector has been taken over by private individuals who rely on tacit support from government institutions, and the entire economy is based upon land sales, and the funding of municipal governments is totally dependent on selling land to private developers and private developers being able to source funding from banks, and those banks are state-owned. So then it's basically they are borrowing money from one arm of the government to give it to another arm of the government, and in between, a lot of houses get bought and built. And that circular motion, just creating debt upon debt. And China is now attempting to engage in forensic accounting. They're going through off the balance sheet liabilities of municipal governments. They started off with Beijing, and in just the first round, they found 75 billion. So we're talking about gargantuan sums of money that are going to come into the forefront of public discourse over the course of the next year. And that's what we're starting to see now in this downward pressure on the real estate sector. Because it's looking increasingly likely that the government is, what they're trying to do is sift between the assets that they have to save and those that they can't save. So we're seeing this extraordinary pressure coming to bear on portions of the property market. That is feeding through into the banking sector. So when we think about Chinese banks, those are arms of the government. And again, we have this extraordinarily lengthy range and failed upside breaks. Now we still have the sequence of higher reaction lows, but if it starts breaking those, well, then it's quite likely that it will come all the way back down. So if you have a debt problem and a property problem, there's only one solution for that. And it means you have to cut rates and you have to devalue the currency. So, if China devalues the currency, and they allowed the currency to appreciate meaningfully in 2020, well, it would suggest that we're going to see it happen in a very short period of time, and it would be, I think, a very conservative view that China would just allow the currency to go back to 7. I think it's much more likely that it would go back to 8. So we're talking about a profound devaluation of the currency to try and stimulate inward investment and to solve some of the problems that they have with excessive debt. And of course, China has been very reluctant to open back up. And a lot of people in China fear that what Xi is trying to do is to close up the economy just like Mao did. And that he doesn't want people leaving the country. And he doesn't want people coming in. And he's happy for business to take place, but only to the extent that it supports the economy and the political narrative. So, as we look at the ramifications of the pandemic, the easy predictions have been that things would change, and people are thinking about that everyone now understands whether they are a work from home kind of person or not. And my view, and I've been working from home since 2007, is that you don't work from home, you live at work. And I get to spend a great deal of time with my family, and I really enjoy it. And I think I'd have difficulty living in an office or working in an office again. And that's obviously one of the things that's changed during the pandemic. But at the challenge for a calcified political system like a communist authoritarian regime is that they haven't got an easy way to adjust, so they're not flexible. And the great benefit of democracy is that it is flexible and it's messy, and there's a great deal of acrimonious dispute and messy transfers of power, and the pendulum can swing not at all from right to left and violently from right to left. And sometimes it feels like nothing can get done. But ultimately, people will vote in their best interests, and whatever is in people's best interests will eventually align with a benign outcome. But in an authoritarian regime, they have total control until they have no control. And then you move into a very difficult position. So we're definitely seeing that iron ore prices have pulled back a lot, and they've just about started to steady in the region of the September low. And coal prices have been coming back as well. So some of those inflationary pressures are starting to moderate. But the big question is, will China try to stimulate? Will they try to start to encourage additional speculation in the property market? And that's been the view of a lot of Chinese people, that this is all part of a continuation of policy that they will try, inevitably try to control the property sector and ultimately fail because they haven't got the appetite for the kind of economic pressure that would come to bear. But the reality is that politicians never voluntarily take on these kinds of challenges. They will only take them on when they have to. And the debt to GDP ratio for China is extremely high when we take total debt. But the big problem is that there are unknowns in terms of off-balance sheet liabilities. And this is the race that's going on. Because foreign direct investment is something that China has excelled at attracting. And now everyone is looking through the books and trying to figure out where the debts reside and who is the one that's going to experience the most pressure. And that's where the shorts are starting to occur. So this isn't something that's going to become an issue this week or even next week. It's going to take a while because they don't yet know what the problems are. And a handful of the property developers have gone bust so far. So this is still a reasonably manageable problem. But the longer it goes on for without a solution, the worse it's going to get. And there's not a lot of appetite for trying to support the economy again. So we used to have, in much of the world, we look for rule of law. China has often said they rule by law. In other words, they will prosecute you to the fullest extent of the laws they've just made up. But even now, they're starting to move increasingly towards rule by simply writ. And what I found particularly interesting this week was the sex scandal that broke between a member of the Politburo and a tennis star. So this made headlines, not so much because of the details of the affair, but because it was deleted within an hour from Weibo. And of course, one should really be asking the question, why did it come out now? Because it's not simply that the affair occurred, because every one of the communist senior Communist Party officials has had an affair, because they need to have leverage on all of them. But rather, why did it come out now? Well, next week we have the meeting to put in place the structure so that she can retain power at the big party confab this time next year. So that's obviously something that's going to contribute to a lot of stress within the party. And these kinds of stories coming out make sure that people know where they are and how they're going to act, because they understand that if they don't do what they're told, well, then they will be excised. So this is a massive power grab by one individual and his apparatchiks, and he's increasingly trying to take control of every power center within the country. And he's already succeeded with most of them. So this grab for power is a clear authoritarian move. And within that context, well, the big question is about Taiwan, because it has the global supply chain. If there were really going to be if there were going to be an invasion, I would anticipate that the stock market would be breaking down ahead of the event. We've often seen that kind of activity in Israel when a big threat or war is about to start in Israel's immediate vicinity, the stock market generally breaks down in advance of that. And I think that Taiwanese investors are probably more sensitive to the outlook for the relationship with China than anyone else. So this is probably one of the most, I think, the best indices to pay attention to as we address this question. But I do think that if we're talking about where risks reside, well, then China is where the big risk is. It's not going to be in Europe, because we've seen that European indices are only now breaking out of 21-year basis. So when we look at China, what we're seeing is toppy activity. And when we look at Europe, what we're seeing is base formation completion. And when we look at the USA, what we're being presented with are trends that have been underway for more than a decade that are now accelerating. If the renminbi is going to be under pressure, well, then the flight to quality into the dollar could also be quite profound. And that might also help to support the view that the dollar can rebound from here, because it's still a pretty consistent advance. And it has at least stabilized in the region of the lower side of the range. This was another trend that looked like it was losing momentum, and that we were going to see it breaking lower. And now it is starting to rebuild and firming from the region of the trend mean. So I find it particularly interesting that the dollar is appreciating and gold is firming, because usually they go in the opposite direction, and over the course of the last year, they have pretty much gone in the same direction. I think that the continued performance of the Fangman shares is plus Tesla is particularly noteworthy. We had a profound move higher in 2020. We've had a lengthy correction, and now it's right in the region of the peaks. So if this can turn around and resume its advance, well, then we're going to certainly have additional evidence to support the bull market hypothesis. And so far, it's doing just that. So we're still in a bull market environment, and there is the clear potential that we're going to move into a bubbly environment on Wall Street. And if we have a bubbly environment on Wall Street, well, then the continued ability of the crypto sector to attract liquidity will be supported at least. So this is also particularly worth highlighting, because Bitcoin has been pausing, and so far it looks like a consolidation. If it breaks downwards, well, then we're going to move into a lengthier period of consolidation. I've been out of the market, and I'm not really tempted to race back in. I think that just it doesn't look like the kind of attractive trading setup where there's a low risk of pullback that would attract me back into the market. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend. And I do apologize for the mix-up, and wish all the best to all of you.